Cocktail College is brought to you by Mr. Black Cold Brew Coffee Liqueur. Listener, you want to know the secret to a great espresso martini? It's not the vodka, although the vodka does matter. But no, it's the coffee liqueur. And you want to know the secret to a great coffee liqueur? It's coffee. That might sound like a no-brainer, but until Mr. Black came along, people weren't really talking about that. People weren't pulling their own espresso shots in the morning. They didn't care about things like where their coffee came from or when it's roasted. But this is what sets Mr. Black apart. It's made using the finest Arabica coffee cold brew. And you can really taste the difference. And I'm not just saying that because we're partnering with Mr. Black today. I'm saying bartenders have been telling me that for years. Seriously, I remember when it first came along and everyone was recommending it. And I was like, I gotta try this thing. And when I did, I got it. The funny thing is that was years before Espresso Martini Mania. And here we are. And guess what? Mr. Black is now available nationwide. Head to mrblack.co to find the closest retailer to you.
Hey, this is Tim McCurdy, and welcome to Vine Pairs Cocktail College, a weekly deep dive into classic cocktails that goes beyond the recipe with America's best bartenders.
You could argue all cocktails are very social, but especially with a champagne cocktail, I find it to be one that's celebratory and you want to have it with a group. So I think there's so many creative ways to go about it.
Cocktail or category, or maybe even both. That's the big debate at Cocktail College today as we welcome Amy Racine, the beverage director for JF Restaurants. Now, the International Bartenders Association classes today's drink, the champagne cocktail, as a contemporary classic, listing its ingredients as chilled champagne, cognac, Angostura bitters, a sugar cube, and, curiously, a few drops of Grand Marnier. That interesting final component aside, it would seem to confirm this as a cocktail instead of category, but as we'll soon learn from Amy, riffs abound and are easily achieved by switching the base spirit, maybe tweaking a couple of other ingredients. Ultimately, any excuse to use the world's most prestigious and complex sparkling wine as a mixer is a good one in my books. And you know what else? Any opportunity to hear Amy talk about champagne and cocktails and share her wealth of knowledge on those topics should not be missed. So here we are, and here it is. Charmat, Chartreuse, Chandon, Gaston Chiquet, chilled glassware, chilled cognac, citrus, cava, chamomile, Calvados, and, of course, the champagne cocktail. It's a gorgeous day for a champagne cocktail. We're in the studio with Amy Racine. Amy, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
And thank you for helping me with that opening line right there. I didn't know how to get started, and then there you say it. For those in the New York area, it is starting to get very nice these days. And for those listening as the episode or close to it coming out, feels like, and not to make this non-evergreen, but does feel like we've just hit that time of year where we had a day a couple of weeks ago that was really unexpectedly nice. It was a Sunday. And every single person was just at a bar all day.
Yeah, I forgot about that one. I was going to say you're going to jinx it, but I guess that this is maybe the start of...
Maybe.
Yeah.
We'll see.
Then comes more rain and then we're okay.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. This is... Don't they call this one like false spring or whatever? Or just getting our hopes up? But there we go.
Yeah.
So we said perfect day for a champagne cocktail, which is actually a really good way to get into this because... That leaves it suitably ambiguous because this is, as we're going to discuss, this could be seen as a single cocktail, the champagne cocktail, or a category of cocktails, champagne cocktails. Amy, what's your thoughts there?
You know, every time I order a champagne cocktail, the response is different. So I don't know if I even know what I think. Sometimes it's, okay, what kind of champagne cocktail do you want? Or they go for a champagne cocktail. When I say a champagne cocktail, I mean... The classic champagne cocktail. Yes.
What about this drink, therefore, for those listening who aren't too familiar with it, they might know some other ones, some that we've even covered on the show, or at least one, the French 75, spoiler alert. But what makes this a cocktail, or does it even class as a cocktail?
Oh, I think it classifies as a cocktail. So it's brandy, cognac specifically, sugar cube, doused in bitters, and should be true champagne.
Top with true champagne there.
True champagne.
And, you know, that definitely does align with that classic, you know, cocktail definition that we often refer to on this show, which is, and I always need to write it down, a stimulating liquor composed of spirits of any kind, sugar, water, and bitters. I guess the champagne's taking the place of water, or ice in this case, which is great. Yeah. Who doesn't want that?
Yeah, it's mostly water.
Exactly.
It's a cocktail.
But also, you know, there is that brandy versus no brandy debate. And I mm-hmm. think we'll get into this in a second too. But this is when you're trying to search for the champagne cocktail online. There's just so many different versions out there. Some calling brandy, some not calling for brandy. I like the fact that you're firmly in the brandy camp.
Yes. I think these days I expect brandy in a champagne cocktail when I order a champagne cocktail. I was surprised by all of the different, not the modern variations of it, but historically all the different ways it was made when I was digging into this a bit. But it seems as though it kind of started as a, well, sometimes ice, sometimes not, sugar, bitter sometimes, garnish sometimes. So, which I guess is the story for most
right.
cocktails that are out there in the great debate of who created it and when did it officially become right. what it is. But yeah, there's a bunch of different versions out there. And sometimes they even call out specific producers in the champagne camp as well. So,
which is super interesting because, you know, on one of our sister podcasts here, Wine 101, our good friend and host there, Keith Beavers, is currently doing a massive deep dive on champagne as a region and champagne as a style of wine. And one thing that I really enjoyed while listening to that and was just this idea that modern brands or labels, especially within wine, but also spirits too, like, it's a much more recent concept than you might imagine, right? It was more like this idea of bulk wine or bulk spirits that we have now that might have been sold to wholesalers or bonders. But interesting, yeah, that you're saying that you do see some specific brands even called out historically.
Yes. I saw Mum specifically called out in one recipe, you know, different levels of, is it VSOP, cognac, is it something else?
Mm-hmm.
There's a few different versions. And one of my favorites and probably the one that has the most commentary to it and the most opinion to it is David Embry's. And he kind of goes on a soapbox about it, which I appreciate and I find pretty funny. But he calls the cocktail a mess that no real champagne lover would drink. Also, there's a lot of detail in it of your alcohol needs to be frozen, your glass needs to be frozen. And then, I mean, there's ones before that, too, that omit brandy. And then there's ones after it where they're basically kind of making like a smash almost in a glass. So, yeah, it's kind of all over the place, but it's really interesting.
And would Embry, would his be one of the first mentions that we're seeing of this? Or are we seeing it before? Obviously, Embry's fairly, not modern either, but definitely not, you know, Jerry Thomas.
Yeah.
Era of writer, and also just shocking that he had an opinion that's not like him.
There's the first one that I saw was 1855, crushed ice, comma, sugar, bitters in a tumbler with Mum. So that was the one that called out Mum.
Wow.
Then there's The Ideal Bartender, 1917, which is a lump of sugar, thin glass, small piece of ice, basically building glass with bitters, lemon peel, champagne. We have Craddock, 1930, put Weiss into a tumbler with a lump of sugar, saturate it with Angostura bitters, add another lump of ice, fill the glass with champagne, squeeze a lemon peel, serve with a slice of orange. And then the most recent that I saw that is, I think, in the world of what we're expecting today is the Waldorf Astoria bar book, 1935. One lump of sugar, two dashes of Angostura bitters, which I see specifically called out two dashes these days. One piece lemon peel twisted and fill the glass with champagne and brandy.
That to me, I think that's a great point. That mm-hmm. to me feels like the version of this drink that I would expect or hope for if I ordered it at a bar today. Just that very act of soaking the sugar
It's very cool. Like if you're making an old fashioned or whatnot, like it's cool to see. You can actually see this here as well. In you know, are they calling that out to do that in the glass? Sorry, or is that?
It wasn't saying to do it in the glass. But there wasn't anything suggesting otherwise either. But up until this point, it seems as though there were World of Drinks said to add 6 drops of bitters. So the level of sugar, bitters seems to be dialed down quite a bit over time, which I appreciate because I think one of my biggest qualms with champagne cocktails these days are having too much bitters. You don't need that much.
Right. And why use that wonderful sparkling wine, the world's most famous, arguably, and most prestigious, again, arguably, but I don't think there'll be two people arguing that, on that one.
Yeah.
If you're going to douse it with 6 dashes of bitters, I guess they might not be calling out the brand there, and that's by the by, but, you know, any self-respecting bitters should hijack a cocktail if there's 6 ounces of it, and yeah.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, 6 dashes is a lot for any cocktail, but you're going to wipe out champagne for sure. For sure.
So we're going to race ahead of ourselves just a little bit here, because this is the thing that makes me worry about this drink a little bit, or when I think about making it, which is that whole dilemma of, you know, there's the romanticism, I guess, if you will, of building this in a glass and, you know, adding the sugar first, dousing it a little bit with bitters, maybe adding your brandy, muddling, adding the champagne. I'm like, how are we fully incorporating those ingredients? How are we making sure everything's cold enough? Or are you doing it the separate way and then adding into the glass as you would maybe like shaking up a French 75? Like, I guess, spoiler alert, what's your take on this?
I think, so if you go to any above average bar around us right now and you order a champagne cocktail, the brandy that's going into it is going to be room temperature. That's my experience in ordering. And the type of champagne that's going to be going into it is whatever the house champagne is, if there is one. So the point that you made about, is it cold? Is it stirred? I didn't see anything where anybody was ever stirring it. But to put brandy in the freezer in especially a city like this where there's limited space anyways, and everybody is lucky to have a freezer and lucky to have ice, you're probably not putting brandy for the handful of champagne cocktails you're having ordered a year in the freezer. So it's either you're going to stir it or you're going to put the brandy in. And it seems that the default is to just put the brandy in off the shelf. So that alters the temperature, and it's something that you really want ice cold.
Right.
So that's kind of, you know, strike one on handing over a great cocktail. It's now, you know, a few degrees warmer because of that.
And, you know, here's where there's multiple different reasons why you're the ideal guest for today's episode and for this cocktail. But here's the first one. You know, you have an incredible knowledge and experience in both of these fields. And I was hoping you could therefore maybe chat us through the logistics of putting this on. So, you know, you're not purely thinking about cocktail programs or wine. Like, I'm sure you're often thinking about how everything comes together in one space. Mm-hmm. So for those trying to put this on the menu and trying to make it maybe one of their kind of house drinks or something they're known for, how do you navigate that? How do you make sure, like, yeah, that you have cold brandy, or probably more importantly here, that you're not wasting champagne, which is an expensive product?
Right. Yeah, I think, you know, if you have the opportunity to put it on your menu and to highlight it, whether you're going the classic version or making it your own, is the way to go, because you'll sell more and have the opportunity to use that champagne that you've opened more. I think you could argue all cocktails are very social, but especially with a champagne cocktail, I find it to be one that's celebratory and you want to have it with a group. So I think there's so many creative ways to go about it, and that I've seen, but, you know, you could do, for lack of a better word, like a large format cocktail, basically, where you can offer the offerings. Maybe the brandy is in a carafe on ice.
Ooh.
Select a bottle of champagne off of the menu, build your own. Perhaps, you know, if that's not an option, doing the stir and chilling your champagne glass, if you can, would be a great way to go. But I think, you know, kind of to your note earlier about, is it a category? Is it a cocktail? I think there's a few ways you can go about it. People love to see those on a menu. When you read it, it feels luxury and it feels kind of pinkies up, and who doesn't want to feel that way? So yeah, I think that there's probably a few different ways you could go about it, but for, you know, somebody to take their own spin on it and to market it would be helpful.
Yeah, right. And knowing that, okay, and we're going to do a deep dive on champagne. There's no better episode for us to do so, and we'll do that in a little while. But, you know, knowing that if you put this on a bar menu or a restaurant bar menu, probably might be the ideal home for it. Mm-hmm. You need to have a champagne by the glass on the menu too that works for this drink and is probably attractive for people to buy, right? So that you kind of cover your bases there.
Yeah, I mean, ideal scenario, if you're selling a champagne cocktail, you're using the most appropriate champagne for a champagne cocktail, which is usually the more expensive ones, but more like brioche, toasted, nutty flavors, perhaps a vintage. And you could argue that that, you know, ruins the champagne, but, you know, you could argue it both ways. Using an appropriate cognac or brandy for it as well, depending on the champagne that you're using. And, you know, if you think about it, if you're just going for, reaching for your by the glass bubbles, especially right now, the taste for champagne is so lean and tart and high acid. So if you're reaching for one of those, I would argue that that's better in a French 75.
Yeah.
More botanical.
Especially if you're going that
citrus.
Gin route as well.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. So the brioche kind of style that I was just mentioning isn't necessarily behind everybody's bar. So if you have a way to do a great half bottle or something like that in order to, you know, make sure you're not going through waste and, you know, you're still running a business, but to kind of focus in on what is the best ingredient, just like we do for every other cocktail. Mm-hmm. What is the best ingredient here and how can we maximize our ability to use those ingredients? And champagne is something that just dies so quickly. It's something you really got to put some effort and thought into.
I love that, right? Why should we, just because it's difficult, like, why should we be considering any kind of compromise here? We don't do that with any other drink that we talk about on this show. Or like you say, any cocktail that people are coming up with for their bar programs. When you were talking about all of that, I had it might be a terrible idea. It might be a light bulb moment here.
I love it. Let's go.
So we're in this era of signature drinks, weddings, and events. Mm-hmm. You said, and this is what sparked it for me, celebratory drink. What could be a better way to kick off a reception or something? Like, maybe you're pouring champagne, or maybe you're saying, you know what, we're going to combine the champagne and the cocktail. It's going to be the champagne cocktail. Then you can have your ingredients at the coldest temperature. Mm-hmm. Then you can have them ideally suited for them. And yeah, it's probably going to be an expensive signature drink, but what a way to make a splash.
Yeah, definitely. And there's, I mean, you can buy so many shapes of sugar cubes right now. You can have fun with it. You can, the service style, you could drop the cubes in, do some sort of moment that way. So many different types of bitters. Everybody listening probably knows that. You can, you know, alter the recipe kind of however you want. And, you know, tweak to make your own variation or riff on a champagne cocktail. I think that's a great idea.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Do we want to get into riffs now or do we want to get into riffs after? That is the question here, because that is another aspect of this that we've teased already with the, you know, that debate at the beginning, which is, you know, is it a category? Is it a single drink? The argument for saying it is a category is that there are all these different riffs that are also very similar. So I guess I just made the decision there. We're getting into the riffs
now. Yeah, we're pulling over. We're doing the riffs.
we're pulling over here. Right, exactly. Let's talk about some of those, because some very famous drinks in that category as well.
Yeah. So one of my personal favorites, French 75, gin, citrus-based, air, male, rum-based, a Ritz, which is triple sec and maraschino, old Cuban, which I was saying before is basically like the mojito of,
of champagne
cocktails.
Nice.
Prince of Wales, so that has Grand Marnier, and I think would have a moment right now with all the Kate Middleton stuff going on. Death in the Afternoon with Absinthe.
And that's the Hemingway one,
yes.
Right there, which I've never had, but I would imagine is also a bit of an abomination when it comes to balance. What is that, equal parts champagne and absinthe?
I don't think it's equal parts. I think, I mean...
Or it's a lot of absinthe considering, right?
It is. And to me, it's fun. And probably just like we were saying with a champagne cocktail, there's probably a particular champagne out there that would be best for it, like a spicier one. But it kind of... I know Pastis has one on the menu, or at least used to, and I had it there, and I was just so interested in it. It kind of has like a Szechuan peppercorn kind of sensation, like it's numbing, and then you're like, what's going on? And then all of a sudden, you're very alert of your surroundings, and it's a pretty fun, like thought-provoking cocktail, mm-hmm. I think.
I love that point, and again, we're pulling over even further to the side here, but... You know, you talk about absinthe there and absinthe and champagne together and that almost like that numbing sensation. I think that there's this category of comestibles or digestibles as well, of things that seem to have an effect beyond purely what they are. So I know that's very vague. So I'm talking about there, like, yes, people have talked about absinthe for a long time and there's all these myths about that it makes you hallucinate. And we know that's not true, but I do think that being tipsy on absinthe is different to a different feeling, mm-hmm. or the way that an ice cold martini hits, or the way that champagne makes you feel compared to other products, or, and the last one here, caviar, but more than that, oysters. Mm-hmm. I think that there's these things, and maybe it's just the prestige around them and the reputation, but I do feel like whether you're consuming any of those, it does something different than purely intoxicating you or filling you up.
Right. It's there's kind of like a luxury with luxury kind of thing, or kind of a Gatsby like kind of mood, yeah, that goes with it. It's, yeah, that's interesting, because the absinthe drinker isn't necessarily the champagne drinker, and you put them together and like, who is this person?
Who is the absinthe drinker in 2024?
I think we all are at the right time of, yeah, night or day. I don't know.
Folks hanging around at Maison Premier, probably, yeah, presumably.
Yeah. Definitely, yeah.
So, yeah, really interesting family of riffs there. But we figured we will keep this more focused on this and treating it as the cocktail that it is and deserves. Mm-hmm. Speaking of maybe riffs or versions, before we get into individual ingredients, as is often the case, the IBA version of this is kind of interesting. Calls out cognac specifically and not brandy, but also has some weird other things going on. Am I right?
Yes. I think one, there's, so Grand Marnier is optional.
Grand Marnier is also potentially in there?
Yes. According to what I saw.
Yeah.
And then zest and I think it, and cherry. I think, mm-hmm, it specifically said maraschino cherry.
Maraschino, yeah,
correct.
I believe so.
Which is, it seems heavy. But also if you think of, I guess if you're going cognac, that's like kind of stone fruit flavors. Maybe it's not.
Yeah.
I don't know. What do you think?
I'm thinking that someone accidentally, you know the whole Negroni...
knocked over the cherry jar into the glass. Or,
I'm thinking like someone, the Negroni Spagliato myth, I'm thinking someone accidentally poured champagne into their sidecar, maybe?
Oh.
Or they didn't have lemon, but they were like, here, we have this really nice, tart, vibrant champagne, mm-hmm, acidic, this will work instead. I don't know. It just, yeah, seems like an odd combination. And yeah, if you're adding the Grand Marnier, then you get the orange. I don't know where the cherry comes from. Maybe they were also from Wisconsin and were used to making old fashions that way.
Yeah. That's an interesting thought, because all of the other cocktails that we were, or champagne cocktail variations that we were mentioning, are basically, it's a champagne cocktail riff on other cocktails. So you can almost touch every other spirit out there and, you know, name one of the top five classic cocktails of that spirit, and you can find a champagne cocktail based off of it. I love that sidecar reference.
Yeah, it's a weird idea there. And yeah, also, what is the IBA doing? Why are they always making their drinks not the standard one? Like, we run into this a lot when we're researching recipes here. We're like, well, every other site is saying the same thing, or every book says the same thing, but then the standard one you're supposed to know, I guess, for exams?
Mm-hmm.
I don't know what's going on over there.
Keeping everybody on their toes, I guess. I don't know.
So we've spoken a little bit, you know, we've touched upon this a little bit, and I think it's a really nice segue from history and riffs into ingredients, but we're going to arrive there by way of profile. Mm-hmm. Tell me what you're expecting if you go out and you're like, this place is known for the champagne cocktail. You have to try it. What are you expecting from them? What kind of flavor profiles do they have to hit?
Mm-hmm. So I guess starting with temperature, I would expect very cold, frosty glass. As far as flavor profile goes, leaning into it should, in my mind, amplify the flavors of the champagne, which is also to me arguably one of the weakest or least concentrated ingredients in terms of flavor profile, the most delicate, but also arguably the most complex. So take a great champagne that has those, again, brioche flavors, orchard fruit flavors, which comes from stirring the lees and getting that kind of like buttery, nutty kind of flavor profile, minerality, something that you can't necessarily mimic elsewhere. And the beauty of that coming from chalk soils, and it kind of comes across as like a briny sensation. Before I move on to other ingredients, also the level of effervescence should be persistent but fine.
Mm-hmm.
So not like a Prosecco, for example, where there's a ton of big bubbles. Something more like San Pellegrino versus like Schweppes Club Soda.
Yeah. Charmat method out the window. No thanks, guys. Not
exactly.
For this one.
Yeah, not
we're going
here.
Traditional.
Yeah. And then if you have, I think brown sugar cubes in mm-hmm. this case, same reason, more like molasses brown flavors in the sugar, quality sugar. Keeping the, you know, Angostura bitters are specifically called out, but keeping that level, like we mm-hmm. discussed, at bay, just two dashes. And then your cognac echoing the flavors of the champagne. So more of those kind of soft, like almond kind of flavors. And one thing I didn't mention is the citrus tones in the champagne as well. And if you are going to do an expression, that could bring it out. But sweeter citrus flavors like mandarin and tangerine, not, you know, lemon and lime juice, or zest and oil mm-hmm. kind of flavors. That would be, to me, the most ideal champagne cocktail.
That's so fascinating and explained in such an incredible way that as I'm listening, I'm visualizing this. And what I visualize there is this really interesting journey, right? Which begins, and each step of the way is kind of linked. You start with cognac, the nuttiness. That's informing perhaps, not that we're saying cognac's the most important thing, but that's informing the style of champagne that we're going to speak about. But the nuttiness, the tie-in there. And then from that, this is the hardest bridge to jump, but our gap to bridge. But I'm sure you can link the champagne to the brown sugar in a way which then links to the Angostura, which then also lends itself to those, you know, like an orange peel versus, like you say, citrus lemon there. But there really is this clear progression when you talk about that way and this harmony of ingredients.
Yeah. And also the thing about the sugar is, you know, if you're using a really quality champagne, you don't necessarily need help with the bubbles, but it also does kind of, you know, help out with that. But if you use a drier or an especially dry champagne, then you're adding back just like a little bit of sugar just for texture and body. And then there's also that journey of starting when almost no sugar has come off the cube to when you finish and then you have that last sip of more bitters and more sugar. And I'd argue that after, you know, 80% of a champagne cocktail, it's like one delicious, like, oh, I'll have another.
Well, you know, I think that does lead us to definitely be exploring champagne now. And also for me to air, I don't want to call it a grievance here because I don't want to judge anyone for what they drink, but I just want to maybe call out the fact that I think we have gone a little bit too far when it comes to this idea of what we should be drinking when it comes to champagne right now. And it's headed in this extreme, which is much the same way as the daiquiri. And I think there are kind of, I don't think that's no coincidence when people are talking about like they want their dry to be brut nature. and they want it to be blanc de blanc or, you know, completely fruit. And that somehow if you tend towards those more toasty, yeasty, autolytic notes, right, that you're, I don't want to say inferior, but you know what I mean here. Or I get that impression because I am that kind of champagne drinker. And it's kind of the same we see with daiquiris that people are like, yeah, I like almost no sugar in my daiquiri. I want it to rip the enamel off my teeth. And I'm like, what is that? Like, that's not a balanced cocktail. I don't know. Is that, or are we past that already? It felt like we were in this moment of brut nature or you're not cool.
Yeah. Everybody wants to say that they love dry and high acid, and then everybody's drinking, you know, frappuccinos and bubble tea. And it doesn't make sense when you look around. But perhaps for just, you know, a guest coming in off of the street, the buzzword and the kind of more fashionable thing to say when you're ordering any wine is dry. You know, there's, you know, the versions of that for cocktails as well. But, you know, the drier the better right now. But I'd argue there's a difference between dry and fruit, and something that has brioche and more apple, pear kind of flavors, just because it has that flavor profile doesn't mean it has actual residual sugar. So that's, you know, you only have so much time with your guest and you don't want to get on a soapbox, you know, in your restaurant, but or at your bar. But I think that's the kind of struggle right now to relay.
And also in the wine conversation there too, I think, like you say, it's kind of fashionable to say you want dry, but I'm sure as a beverage professional, you yourself know that when most people say that, and if you serve them something that was technically like bone dry, they wouldn't like it.
Yeah. Like you said, like rip your enamel off. Yeah. Yeah. Some people like truly love it, and I totally respect that. But I mean, champagne, unless you're getting like demi-sec or like something that was designed to be a dessert champagne, you're not going to have residual sugar. I mean, there's sugar in the champagne for balance, but it's, you know, it's a body textural thing.
And the thing that's also always interesting, and look, we're all hypocrites here, is that like, I feel like that movement of beverage professionals that really kind of championed that style, or is like, it's this or nothing. There's a brand that they all love and that they will never turn down a glass of. And it has nothing to do with that style. Can you guess which brand I'm talking about?
Krug?
Yeah. 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 Right.
I didn't know if it was a setup. Okay, yeah, Krug.
Yeah. No one will ever turn down a glass of Krug. The most oxidative, I know I was going to struggle with that one too. Or Solos, I guess, which is a even harder to find, you know, similar profile though, right? That kind of Solera heavy method. It is just funny that those two things go hand in hand, and yet they seem to be completely opposed.
Yeah, it's true. And there's something, well, with the Krug reference in particular, or, you know, you name it in the Krug kind of world. There's something though, for a champagne cocktail, it is a champagne cocktail and it warrants champagne, and that comes with price. But if you're looking to, you know, invest one evening on a bottle of champagne, there's a comfort in seeing a name that you recognize. And there's also like a status to it. So yeah, it's a brand.
It is. It is. And, you know, they've been very successful at being a brand, as has champagne as a region, right? Like champagne is the maybe only Bordeaux can rival champagne as a region historically that has been as much about being a brand and having an identity as it has as much the wine. And I'm nothing against the wines. I think they're incredible regions. But you know what I mean? Like they've really leaned into the aspect of being brands versus humble growers and, you know, purely only terroir.
I think you're right. Anytime you're, you know, discussing any sort of protection in reference to like a region or grape variety, the reference is always you can't call champagne unless it comes from champagne. and that's how you explain,
meme, right?
You know, Chablis and Chardonnay or whatever it is. Yeah. Yeah. That should be a hat.
Yeah.
I'd wear it.
I'm realizing that this is just going to turn into a full-blown geeky champagne episode here, which is great.
Let's go back to the cocktails. Yeah.
No. I'm like, look, when are we going to get to cover this again? And we won't go too far, but it's a great opportunity, and it's not something we get to do very often here at Cocktail College. So we mentioned maybe two ends of the spectrums there, and you know, I would imagine also Krug might. Price-wise, probably, you know, count this one out too. Mm-hmm. But I imagine we're landing somewhere in the middle there when you spoke about like the profile. Would you lean for a Blanc de Noir at this point? You know, Pinot Noir and Meunier. Mm-hmm. Would you go for that? Would you say that maybe has more of a chance, or it really just does depend on the producer?
When you were saying like a Blanc de Noir, I was just thinking, oh, that would be probably very, very good. In one, especially if you tweak your brandy for it. I think to answer your question, it's both. It's the producer and the style. Mm-hmm. And it's unfortunate from, you can't give a blanket statement or kind of a answer, but it's also, I think, really exciting because there's so many different types of champagne that are out there and so many different ways that you can lean into a champagne cocktail. And we do have at the edition in Tampa, we have a restaurant there called Lilac, and it's a more formal restaurant, won Michelin star last year, chef's table, beautiful kitchen. We decided to feature a champagne cocktail cart there.
Amazing.
And we have a full cocktail menu as well, but this is what we're highlighting, and we select four different types of, the process starts with the bubbles, what champagnes do we want to highlight, or what sparkling wines, I should say, do we want to highlight? So on that cart, we have sparkling that comes from the Rhone Valley of France, and it's a very deep rosé, more like blackberry, brambly, black pepper, spicy kind of flavors. We have a Blanquette, which is more high acid, tart, lemon, zesty, fun, cheerful. No comparison at all, but kind of our answer to an entry-level sparkling kind of, I was going to draw a line to Prosecco, but it's not fair at all. Mm-hmm. It's the entry-level sparkling. We have Dom Perignon, because we do have one luxury, what we call luxury champagne cocktail on there. And then we usually have one other, and it's something to have fun with. Perhaps there's a sparkling from, you know, South America we're interested in, or whatever it is. And then from there we go, what are the flavors that are unique to this bottle of bubbles and how can we amplify it? And we make a champagne cocktail based on that. You know, it rotates. Sometimes we'll do something that's more vegetal. Sometimes we'll do something that leans into those more like brambly, darker flavors. The Dom Perignon one has luxury ingredients. It's the Grand Marnier Cuvée Alexander and gold flakes and the whole whole nine arts. The gold flakes dance in the bubbles, though, so it's kind
that of, sounds incredible.
Yeah, and then you know, stemware to match, kind of more of a visual representation. So all that's to say is that, you know, you can go to the store and pull a bottle of champagne that you like and taste it and say, what do I taste here? And then, you know, look at the world of spirits that you have on your home bar, your back bar, and kind of like back into it. And I think that's something, that's a place where in restaurants I wish saw more collaboration between the somm and the bartender, because I think there's a bunch of ways that both could work together in, you know, these are the flavors of the wine, and then bartender knows like this brand of gin or this bottling of this brand of gin is exactly the flavors that you just described, and you can have a lot of fun with it.
That's very cool.
Yeah.
I would also totally drink the hell out of a Dom Perignon champagne cocktail.
Come on down to Tampa.
I was wondering, and this is purely with personal interest in mind here, or personal preference. One of my favorite, I love sparkling wines and I love champagne. I don't always have a champagne budget. And I also don't have the budget for the champagnes I would like to drink. Now, again, we're not drinking Krug all the time in my house, but, you know, maybe some of the other ones I'm like, you can get more value elsewhere. But if I really am just like picking up something quick, ideally cold, and I will say the word cheap here, but that might work for this. And we're staying in America, Nevada, I think, or New Mexico, Gruet.
Yeah, Gruet.
I feel like that definitely has the profile that could work for this drink, or the profile that we're talking about there. And it's definitely a budget option. Budget's a better word than cheap.
Yeah, it's, I mean, if you want to have a champagne cocktail on a, it's just like opening champagne every night of the week. It's not feasible for most of us. So, and it's interesting to see someone's expression of, if I was to do this in another place, then what's normally expected, mm-hmm. what would it be? I think Gruet is a lot of fun, and I've been there once, and you just like leave city proper and you're looking at a vineyard in New Mexico. It's like, what is going on?
Great American sparkling wine there,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
Traditional methods.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Here's a quick one just in terms of, because I think your answer is great. You're like, you know, it really depends. And a lot of the answer to these questions are, it depends. I'm guessing a lot of our listeners, too, are more on the spirits and cocktail sides of things, or maybe we get some crossover.
Mm-hmm.
Hello, wine drinkers, wine lovers. For those who aren't, can we do some recommendations at just different tiers of, like, where we would be going that are bottles or house styles or maisons that that you're like, okay, this is fitting within everything we've spoken about today. So we established that maybe a good entry level there might be Gruet, or you might find a little bit more value there than you're finding in champagne.
Mm-hmm.
If I'm going to go up a notch, and we're going to say it's not an everyday sipper, but it's also, it could be a Friday night one, or maybe you had a good week at work or whatever. Like, what would be that next tier up of champagne or sparkling wine? Which house would be good for this profile?
Champagne specific?
Mm-hmm.
If it wasn't, I was going to say Grimona Cava, I think is, you know, they have some pricey bottlings, but they have some very fair bottlings as well. And I think Cava is one of the better answers to a non-French,
great,
non-champagne sparkling that isn't French. Guimea is a new one that I've discovered that I think is delicious. Sus is another great, sometimes affordable. I mean, you're talking affordable being like 40, 50 bucks, I guess. Because if you're getting like really entry level, if you find a $30 champagne, that's...
Yeah, don't.
It
don't.
Doesn't.
Put it back on the shelf. What about 50, 60? Or what about maybe, this might be a better way to frame it too, mm-hmm. as well. And not that I'm trying to get you to commit to big houses here or whatnot, but just like...
Oh.
Or larger names. Tanger maybe?
Yeah.
Tanger, sorry.
Tanger, yeah. Yeah, Tanger is great. And, you know, one I was thinking when you were saying Gruet, Domaine Carneros is another great,
amazing
domestic sparkling house.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I do like Tanger a lot.
I'm just trying to think of those champagnes that have that little, basically, this is the style that I like drinking. So I'm thinking about the ones that I go towards.
Heidsieck.
Heidsieck, yeah.
Heidsieck I like a lot.
Depends on which one as well, I guess. But I do have an affinity for Louis Roederer. Again,
Roederer is very
Roederer,
good.
Yeah.
Paul Roger.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So these are all great examples of those champagnes that, like, yeah, it's going to be slightly more expensive than your average cocktail ingredient, or definitely than your average mimosa or whatever, French 75, but these are perfect for it and easy to find.
Yes. And in addition to the easy to find, they're consistent, which one of the beautiful things about champagne, but would probably be frustrating from trying to create a standardized cocktail in your bar kind of point of view, is that it's produced the same way every time, affordable, and it's not your like big blown up brand name as well. Yeah.
My favorite thing about champagne, and I say this unironically, is that it's maximum intervention wine making. And I like that. In today's
that should also
landscape.
Be a hat or a t-shirt.
So there we go. From there, we move on to spirits. Let's keep it to brandy or cognac.
Okay.
Let's start with age or category there. What are good examples here? Because, you know, obviously you want it to have a presence, but you don't want it to dominate the drink or be too burly.
Right. Most of the ones that when I'm doing some research, most recipes were calling for VSOP, which I don't disagree with. But I was also thinking, you know, if you are, you know, selecting one of those bottles that we just spoke about and, you know, looking for like a softer style Ferrand, I think is a great go-to because it's smooth and, you know, it's a pretty and I think more delicate style. But then I was also thinking, I guess this kind of, I'm just saying it depends a million times through this conversation. But
no, not that you were saying that. Sorry, I'm saying that that is a true answer. Yeah.
An XO, like a Remy Martin XO kind of is more citrusy and like chamomile kind of flavors. And that can be pretty with like brioche kind of nuttier champagnes. So again, I think it can be very producer specific. And I also am not sure, and I hate to say this, but I don't know if it's like the knowledge or the passion or just the understanding right now of cognac and brandy is as high as other spirits at the moment, or I don't think it is.
No.
So I don't know, you know, just from a, like a, I guess a marketing point of view is where I'm coming from, is how much weight that carries on a menu these days rather than putting cognac and brandy.
That is a great point there. And I think if anything, that could be an opportunity if you're a bartender or beverage professional to actually start a conversation there, right? Like maybe have the champagne that people know and has some prestige or a good recognition, and then flip it where, you know, you mentioned Fronde, which I think is a great example. I think Fronde is that maybe that example where you're getting beyond the massive big three or big four, mm-hmm. but still have great availability and beloved by bartenders, mm-hmm. But produced at a bigger scale than maybe the next tier, which I think can still be affordable, like Node, I don't think, or Noud, N-A-U-D, I think it's Node.
Oh.
I think that has decent scale. Or another one, Doudognon, mm-hmm. I think is another that's, for my palate at least, tends to be very fruity. And also, to your point, that like these cognacs, you'll find some VSOPs of those that are much fruitier and more intense than a lot of the VSs of bigger houses or bigger right. producers. And even up to XO, you know, it's really hard to just make those kind of generalizations.
Right. And also, while you were saying that, I was thinking about, you know, if you go away from cognac, which there is some sort of beauty in the fact that you're doing grapes and grapes, but mm-hmm. if you go away from cognac and you go to the rest of the world of brandy, I think that there's a lot of room for opportunity there. You know, if you have a more like pomace fruit driven bottle of bubbles and you go Calvados or just even a seasonal, you know, there's plenty of options to kind of derail mm-hmm. there.
But yeah, Calvados, incredible. I don't know why they struggled to find that. Calvados is just going to be so good.
Yeah. I mean, or yeah, a pair. There could be so many fun options. And mm-hmm.
Interesting. Yeah. I often find it difficult with these cocktails when it really is like, you know, compared to a Manhattan or a martini or even an old fashioned, people are going to come in here. We're going to have a conversation where people are just like, this is where I'm starting and this is what I'm following up with, or this is what you want, right? Like it's kind of cut and dry. Whereas a drink like this, you're like, you're juggling so many different things and you're really looking for that ideal proportion, which makes it tough when there's so many things at play. But when you do find that combo, it's incredible.
Yeah. And it's a very simple cocktail when you think about it. So you really need to use great ingredients and great quality. And if you have, you know, the story of this producer, whether it's the cognac or the champagne or both, and this is why it's special. And, you know, if you could find a great sugar or bitters you love, it's kind of like the equivalent of having a great simple seafood meal by the water, like seeing, you know, just having a fresh staple ingredient, little olive oil, citrus, salt, like that kind of a thing. Mm-hmm. Let's highlight the product here. What are we talking about? Let's build on it and not mask it too
much.
Yeah,
that's a really great analogy there. You said bitters. We're pretty much sticking to Angostura territory here.
That's what I, just as far as historically and I guess professional recommendations on the mm-hmm. internet are saying. But, you know, I think orange bitters could be fun. Again, the sweeter citrus. Mm-hmm.
Or you just could do Angostura sticking. Orange.
You got two dashes to use.
What about, and this might be the nerdiest question of the day, do you have a recommendation of a preferred sugar? We went into styles earlier. I think we explored that. But you said you have a preferred sugar. I'm like, has Amy got a sugar brand?
Yeah, now I'm going to plug my sugar brand. just kind of, you know, like using cane syrup versus simple demerara. There's so many, I guess there's a handful of, like, I don't want to say basic, but staple ways that you could go about having fun with it.
What about that then? What about a rich demerara syrup?
Yeah.
Just to help with that. If you're, like I was saying earlier, maybe worried about that texture and having those solids within it, I'm sure for some that's the beauty of a drink like this, and the same goes with maybe a old-fashioned. But for others, they're like, we want this perfectly incorporated. Is that something you might recommend?
Yeah, I mean, if you took it more to like the vintage champagne world, which I think is probably a fine line because you start losing bubbles after if you go too old. But when it starts developing more of those like mushroom umami in a good way kind of flavors, and you're using a different like darker style, I think that would be a fun option. Yeah, there's probably a whole world of sugar out there that I have no idea about that I would love to, you know, have a flight of champagne cocktails with different sugars.
Yeah. Well, you know, I'm just going to tease it now. We might very well actually have on the calendar a recording for an episode that a listener requested, actually, that has to do with this very topic. So we'll see. Stay tuned for that one, folks. At this point, Amy, though, we are going to ask you to commit. We're going to ask you to commit to a recipe and preparation of the champagne cocktail that you would serve us today. If we're saying, what is it? This is the drink we want. This is your ideal of a champagne cocktail.
Ideal champagne cocktail. I'm going to start basic while I think it through. But brandy is in the freezer. Brandy is in the freezer. So is the champagne. I think I'm going to go for I'm not necessarily tied to a brand just yet, but I'll say like a recent vintage champagne. So quality from one specific harvest and a brut style for that, again, that body. I would go with a VSOP cognac. That's what's in the freezer. I would have a brown sugar cube. I really like the idea of one dash each of orange and ango. So I'm going to say that. Cube in the glass. And ideally, I'll call it a flute, but really the more narrow AP. So not a traditional flute as we know it in a banquet setting. So more of a bowed glass, cube in, one dash each. The brandy out of the freezer, top with ice cold champagne. Serve.
Any garnish going on there? Any expression?
I would
to start?
Do. Yes. I was just so excited to drink the cocktail.
Me too.
I forgot
and
about
I'm like,
the.
Am I being rude by taking this already to try?
You are. Yeah, because I'm not done yet. And I would do an expression of both orange and lemon discard. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Nice. The phantom rabbit ears there. I'm not sure if anyone calls it that. Might have just invented a third term of the day. Here we go. You see, we're recording slightly later than normal here in the studio. I think this is where I get my best thinking done.
Oh, you're a night. There's a term for that when you do your best thinking at night.
But then again, I also woke up very early this morning to work on something, to write something. And I did think, wow, I was so much more productive doing this. And usually I'm a night worker. So I just, yeah.
Maybe it's just a great day.
It's just delirium.
Yeah, pendulum swinging back.
Amy, listen, we're about to head into the quick hit questions to finish the show. But before we do, is there anything we haven't covered? Do you have any final thoughts on the champagne cocktail or champagne cocktails in general?
You know, the only thing that we didn't touch on, and I think I didn't say it because I'm not quite sure where I land with it yet either, is just for everybody that doesn't have, you know, a narrow champagne glass, like what is it a coupe? Is it a flute? What's the best way to serve it? I think I'm leaning towards like a between the two, probably a flute. Maybe an AP is the best answer. I'm not totally sure yet. I know for a glass of champagne, I would like a white wine glass.
Mm-hmm.
But for the cocktail, I haven't. I'm in between. What do you think?
Yeah, because here's the thing, too, that I think, especially in a lot of cocktail bars, purely cocktail bars that don't specialize in wine, they're probably not going to have very refined champagne glasses, flutes.
Mm.
And I hate a thick flute as much as I hate a thick, in terms of the glass, coupe. It will instantly turn me off the drink. But then you have to consider, this is a bar program we're running. I don't know. I don't have the answer to, I think, like, would you call it a tulip?
For the bowed.
Is that the bowed one?
Yes.
Yeah. But yeah, like a narrow tulip. Something between like a classic kind of, that, which has become, I feel like, almost the norm beyond wine glasses when you're drinking champagne. Somewhere between that and a flute. I don't know. I want to say that the fine folks at Cocktail Kingdom might have one. And if they don't, we're going to go into business on making some champagne cocktail glasses. Or I bet otherwise Rito might have one for sure.
Mm-hmm.
You know, one thing as well, I'm glad you brought us back there for a second, because we didn't get quantities from you. And that also was a question I was going to ask too. Are you going
for
as much
belt?
As... Yeah. Are you going as much as 2 ounces for the base spirit? Is that kind of heavy?
I think it's kind of heavy.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I think an ounce and a half.
Mm-hmm.
And again, it depends, because the size of your flute, coupe, AP, you want to make sure it's full. So your ratio is going to be different all the time. But I guess I would say in general, like an ounce of base spirit to, and then 3 ounces of champagne, so 4 ounce
champagne,
total.
Yeah. Are you jiggering that? Is the other question that I was wondering, because I worry about that as someone who's very bad at bartending.
I think it should be jiggered. Maybe put the jigger in the freezer as well.
Oh, yeah. There we go.
Yeah.
I know what I'm practicing this weekend.
Clear out the freezer.
So are those the final points? Is there anything else we've missed?
There's nothing else. Yeah.
Delicious drink.
Yeah. It's a great cocktail.
More bars in New York should put them on their menus, please. And if you have one and you're listening, this is a great opportunity to remind you folks listening that we have recently, again, launched the Cocktail College at vinepair.com email address. We've been getting some great emails from the listeners, folks asking for specific cocktail episodes for us to color, folks giving us feedback. Thank you so much. We really appreciate that. Keep sending in more. And like I said, if you're running a program with champagne cocktail on it here in New York, let us know. We'll be down very shortly to try that. But first, pressing business to attend to. Amy Racine, question number one here for you today. What style or category of spirit typically enjoys the most real estate on your back bar?
I enjoy vermouth quite a bit, just sipping, and then an expression. So right now, loose style rosé vermouth is one of my favorites.
Especially with that spring popping off right here.
Yeah. And just in case, I just want to say that they are not on the back bar, they're in the fridge, just in case there's any.
Definitely,
somebody's
please.
Saying something.
We just did a roundup recently of vermouths for Manhattans, and it's killing me that I'm blanking on the name, but friend of the show, Jan Warren, sent us in an incredible vermouth, and he texted me, he said, vermouth and soda, that one. It's adult Coca-Cola. I did it. He's right. I've been drinking it ever since.
Oh.
I think vermouth also lasts longer in the fridge than people give it credit for. I don't mind a little bit of oxidation on vermouth.
Yeah, that's a good point. And I mean, not to like keep going back. Well, it's an aromatized wine. Like just the world of fortified, like dessert wines in general, I feel like could be mixed with vermouth so much more than they are as well. Like sub Madeira, sub Banyol, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's a whole like unexplored kind of thing that could happen too.
Malaga.
Sorry?
Don't sell a lot of Malaga these days. That's a weird wine one. question number two. Which ingredient or tool do you believe to be the most undervalued in a bartender's arsenal?
I don't want to say the same thing again, but I was just thinking maybe it is like your wine program. The wine talent that you have on hand, or, you know, and again, going back to the simple syrup kind of a thing, like use sauterne maybe or something like that. I guess I'll answer with the same thing.
That's a great...
Not to beat the drum. I'll get off the soapbox.
It's very
soon.
On brand. And we go with it.
I'm wearing
we love
the
it.
Hat.
What's the most important piece of advice you've received while working in this industry?
Just to listen. Talk less, listen more. Everybody has something that you can pick up and absorb and make your establishment and your life and colleagues' work lives better. So just listen. Yeah.
Love it. All right. Penultimate question today. If you could only visit one last bar in your life, what would it be?
There, I don't know if it's still there, but, and I meant to check it out before this. There's this bar called Stookie's Club Modern in San Francisco. And I used to work and live right across the street from it. And it was my first time being in a city that had great cocktail culture. And it was this like retro kind of bar. And at the time, this was almost 10 years ago now, they were doing classics on their menu, which a lot of people are doing now. But at the time, I was like, look at all these things that I've, like, you know, read about and never had the, like, balls to order in a restaurant. And they've listed it. And I loved it there. And no food, like 10 stools. And the design was very, like, modern as well. So I hope it's still there. It was on Bush and Powell, I think. But if I ever went back, I would go there. Nice. I spent a lot of nights there too, so it's a nostalgia thing.
Yeah, but, definitely. Yeah. That's got to come into this answer. All right, then, final question of today.
Okay.
If you knew that the next cocktail you drank was going to be your last, what would you order or make?
I mean, I don't know why it's my last, so I would go as stiff as possible. I would get like a triple Sazerac or something. Like, why is it my last?
This question
How painful is it going to be?
It's open to interpretation. But
so that's where my mind goes. But if you're asking what would I enjoy first, I love a last word. So I'll do a last word.
Nice. Mm-hmm. What a great, both great drinks. Mm-hmm. I don't know. I'm kind of here for the triple Sazerac, to be honest with you.
Again, why is it my last drink? just high proof.
Yeah, you just
let's get through it.
On your way out. It's good to know. You know what I mean? It's you want to know that the last thing you drank wasn't like a high noon.
Yeah.
Yeah. Accidentally.
Like I said, I love vermouth, but if I knew it was my last drink, it would not be vermouth.
Going down strong.
Yeah.
Well, Amy, thank you so much for joining us today. What a great opportunity to go deep on some champagne there, share some wine knowledge, but not only that, just talk about this incredible drink.
I had so much fun. Thank you for having me.
The pleasure was all ours. Cheers.
Cheers.
Thanks for listening to the Cocktail College podcast. If you enjoy listening to the show anywhere near as much as we enjoy making it, go ahead and hit subscribe and please leave a rating or review wherever you get your podcasts, whether that's Apple, Spotify, or Stitcher. And please tell your friends. Now for the credits. Cocktail College is recorded in New York City and produced by myself and Darby Seaside, who also composed our awesome theme music. Just give that a listen. I also want to give a huge shout out to everyone on the VinePair team, especially co-founders Adam Teeter and Josh Malin, editor-in-chief Joanna Sherino, and art director Danielle Greenberg, who designed our killer logo. Finally, thank you, listener, for making it this far and for giving this whole thing a purpose. Until next time. Cocktail College is brought to you by Mr. Black Cold Brew Coffee Liqueur. Listener, you want to know the secret to a great espresso martini? It's not the vodka, although the vodka does matter. But no, it's the coffee liqueur. And you want to know the secret to a great coffee liqueur? It's coffee. That might sound like a no-brainer, but until Mr. Black came along, people weren't really talking about that. People weren't pulling their own espresso shots in the morning. They didn't care about things like where their coffee came from or when it's roasted. But this is what sets Mr. Black apart. It's made using the finest Arabica coffee cold brew. And you can really taste the difference. And I'm not just saying that because we're partnering with Mr. Black today. I'm saying bartenders have been telling me that for years. Seriously, I remember when it first came along and everyone was recommending it. And I was like, I gotta try this thing. And when I did, I got it. The funny thing is that was years before espresso martini mania. And here we are, and guess what? Mr. Black is now available nationwide. Head to mrblack.co to find the closest retailer to you.